This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recently recorded with comedian Louis C.K. His FX series Louis started its fourth season a few weeks ago after a 19-month hiatus. Louis C.K. created, writes, directs, and stars in the series as a stand-up comic named Louis, who, like Louis C.K., is the divorced father of two young girls. Louis C.K. had prominent roles in two films last year, Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine and David O. Russell's American Hustle. This year, he hosted Saturday Night Live for the second time. Let's start with a scene from episode 2 of this season's Louis. The show often features guest comics playing themselves. In this episode, Jerry Seinfeld has asked Louis to open for him at a benefit for the National Heart Alliance. It's a last-minute request. The comic who was supposed to open had just backed out. Louis agrees and shows up wearing a T-shirt to find it's a black tie event and the guests are super rich. Knowing he's all wrong for this crowd, he walks uncomfortably on stage.
Hi there. Thank you very much. Thank you. Give yourselves a great time for coming out. Give yourselves a round of coming out. Good job for you guys. Hey, it's cold outside. It was pretty warm. I don't know. It's crazy. chickens are dumb, right? They don't even. How long have we been eating chickens and they don't get. They're not a little wary at this point? They don't. Haven't risen up? There's been no Martin Luther chicken. There was one of those. When you go to the supermarket, and not that any of you would ever do your own shopping. I know that you guys don't shop for yourselves, of course, because you all have slaves somehow still. I just mean people that work for you who you don't pay.
Okay, Louis C.K., welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to have your show back on the air. That's such a great example, I guess, of what can happen when you're in front of an audience that isn't your audience and you don't know what you're doing there and neither do they.
Yeah, yes.
What's the worst example of that happening to you?
When I was a young comic, I often ran into situations like that. I think I remember doing shows in country clubs once in a blue moon. I'd be miscast in one of those, and that's always what it felt like. It's beyond not having stage presence. It was like being in the wrong place, being somewhere I just didn't belong.
Did you insult the audience like you did in this?
No, I never did that. I don't think I've ever done that. Well, you know what, though? Actually, I'm remembering better. This show came a little bit from a benefit I did do. I did a benefit that was in a huge place at the Jacob Javits Center. It was way too big.
That's a big convention center in New York.
Massive. And comedy is an intimate thing. And this was a benefit for one of these, huge charities that's almost becomes like a Walmart, one of these massive charities. And Elton John was on before me. And Elton John played like three of his best songs, like Tiny Dancer. And, and they ignored him. They talked over him like he was like a lounge piano player. And I was really startled. And I went on stage and I scolded them for that. I was like, Elton John was up here and you guys just didn't care. And they laughed. And then I sort of made fun of them for being rich. And then it got cold really fast. Like I lost them completely and I couldn't get them back. And this is about a year ago. This isn't that long ago. Totally lost the audience. And it just felt like the power and the wealth in the room created a really strange vacuum that I couldn't fill.
My guest is Louis C.K., and his show Louis is back on the air after a hiatus. I want to play a scene from another episode of Louis. And this is an episode in which you've been trying to go out with one of the waitresses in the comedy club where you work, but she keeps turning you down. But another waitress keeps asking you to hang out. And she seems smart and really funny, mm-hmm. but she's also heavy. She's, you know, somewhere between chubby and fat, depending on the word you want to use. So, and you keep coming up with excuses about why you're busy. And finally, you agree to spend some time with her. You're walking with her along the river. And she starts talking about how difficult it is to be a fat girl and single. And then you try to reassure her that she's not fat. Her name is Vanessa in the show, and she's played by Sarah Baker. So here you are reassuring her that she's not fat.
Mm-hmm. You know, Vanessa, you're a very, really beautiful...
Come on. If I was a very, really beautiful, then you would have said yes when I asked you out. I mean, come on, Louis. Be honest here. You know what's funny? I flirt with guys all the time. And I mean, the great-looking ones, like the really high-caliber studs, they flirt right back. No problem. Because they know their status will never be questioned. But guys like you never flirt with me. Because you get scared that maybe you should be with a girl like me. And why not? You know... If you were standing over there, looking at us, you know what you'd see?
What?
That we totally match. We're actually a great couple together.
That's a scene from Louis C.K.'s show, Louis. I think that's a terrific scene. There's a lot more of it. We just played a short excerpt. I think there's so much truth in what she's saying about how certain men will only be comfortable hanging out with attractive women and certainly will only date a really attractive woman even if they're not attractive themselves. Do you know what I mean? And the way you've written your character in this, he's just like totally pigged out. You know, he's had like two full meals back to back with a really fat friend of his, a male friend. And so it's like, you know, it's so hypocritical that he'd be uncomfortable walking with a fat girl when, you know, one of his good friends is like super overweight and...
Yeah, and he's also him and his friend. That's my brother, actually, on the show, Bobby. We're looking over it, around it, at women on the street and wishing, you know, like we're looking at candy through a window, like though they're very untouchable to us, you know. So it's a weird pecking order.
So how did you start thinking about writing that part for the role of Vanessa? Had you had a similar conversation with somebody? Was somebody you know telling you her point of view? Did you just kind of figure this out yourself?
I actually had a conversation many, many years ago with a guy who was heavy and kind of, you know, big eyebrows and, you know, kind of a guy somebody might, you know, describe as a troll. And he just said, and you're not used to hearing people talk like this, he said, it's not fair that people aren't attracted to me and that I'm just excluded from certain basic human joys that everybody else partakes in. And it's true. I mean, there's always – everybody's in that position somewhere relatively. Not everybody. Some people just seem to be universally attractive. But, I mean, I know what that feels like to – I've been several weights in my life, and I know what it feels like to just feel like you're on the outside looking in of the real party in life, you know? And it's as if in on, there's a lot to be said about it. That's why I was attracted to the idea to write about. Because for one thing, it's sad. It's sad that people can't connect because they're not "quote unquote" attracted to each other.
So, but now that you're so well known for being really funny, now that your show is so good, now that a lot of people talk about you, rightfully so, as perhaps the best comic of your generation, are you much sexier? Do you know what I mean?
Jeez, I don't know. I mean, I don't. I'm not out being single trying to get laid as like I used to be. So I never had a heyday sexually. I mean, I've always been somewhat confident, even though I've been awkward and lumpy. I mean, when I was in junior high school, I asked every girl out, every girl in school. And in high school, too, the cheerleaders, everybody. It never bothered me to get rejected. So I would go up to the cutest girl in school.
Good preparation for being a comic.
Yeah, exactly. What's so bad? You go up to a very attractive girl who's got like, you know, who's like a queen bee. Just ask her out. And I was nobody, but I'd be like, hey, you want to go out with me? And you'd always get at least 1 second of sympathy and kind of, oh, that's no, definitely not. But wow, you came up and asked me. So I don't know. It never bothered me. And so, you know, yeah, I was married and I've had girlfriends and, casual sex, all kinds of stuff. And I'm in a relationship now, so I'm not out. You know, I don't know how sexy I am in the marketplace. I'm not testing it right now.
Your character is always either getting picked up by a woman or trying to hit on a woman. And mm-hmm. he's always winding up with women who are such trouble. Even if they're beautiful, there's something kind of mentally unstable about them. Why is that?
Yeah, I don't know. It sort of became a trend after a couple of seasons. I think the thing to me, what's fun to do with this guy on the show is just put stuff in front of him that he can't resist. You know what I mean? Here's a beautiful woman, and she doesn't seem like a good choice for you, but there you go. There you go doing that. And I think I'm trying to beat something into his head that this season sort of is about making that turn. You know, like the episode about the model, he gets confronted with the idea that if you're intimate with a total stranger, it's a reckless thing to do. You know, getting into bed with somebody who you don't know simply because you liked their body or because they came on to you, these always lead to bad choices. So I like showing a guy deal with bad choices. To me, the show wouldn't be very interesting if I was sort of confronted with all very well-balanced women, and then we go and have coffee and everything works out well, and maybe we kiss, and that's the end of the episode. That's not that funny to me. So I've been playing that game over and over again for a while because it's still fun for me. That's why I'm still telling that story.
At the risk of getting too personal, have you had your share of experiences where you wake up in the morning in a stranger's bed and think, what have I done?
I usually don't make it to the morning in situations like that. I usually find a way to get the hell out of there. Yeah. It's usually right after the act. I'm like, why? This is such a bad idea for both of us. I'm upset for myself and her. I think almost every single time I've had sex with somebody for the first time, I should have waited. Pretty much 100% of the time. I should have waited a little. It never hurts. You get two benefits. One is you realize you didn't want to after all, and there's something about her that, you know, you didn't want to get that intimate. Or you get more fond of each other, and there's more to connect about if you wait.
Part of what you just said sounds like a rehearsal for when your daughters get just a little bit older. Like, take it from me. You should wait.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I do think we should tell our kids when they start making these choices, tell them the real thing. Like, don't tell them hocus pocus, you know, spooky stories. You know, you're going to get – someone's going to kill you. Jesus is going to hate you if you do this. Tell them the truth, which is you're going to feel crappy if you do this. You're going to feel – it's not worth it. Just wait. It's a very big deal to be naked in a room with a human being, to be naked in a bed with another person. That is so intimate. That's such a big deal. And when you don't treat it like a big deal, you get confronted with how big a deal it is as a surprise when you're – you know, when that urge is over that got you there. So, yeah, it took me, you know, about 1,000 repetitions of the mistake to sort of start to think of it as one, which I think is probably pretty common.
You've hosted Saturday Night Live twice.
Yeah.
And it's great because your opening monologue, it doesn't seem like the kind of opening monologue that the scriptwriters write for most of the guests. It seems like you bring your stories and you tell them as if you were the comic whose show it was. You don't do the typical guest host thing. And your monologues have been great. And I want to play an excerpt of the most recent one. And so this is Louis C.K. on Saturday Night Live. And you manage to talk about religion in this.
Personally, I don't think there's a heaven. I think maybe there's a God, but there's no heaven. I think that's the best news you're going to get. You die, and you're like, hey, God. And he's like, yep. And you're like, where is heaven? And he's like, I don't know who's telling people that. I don't. But I'm supposed to make a universe and then another whole amazing place for afterwards? You guys are greedy down there. Well, where do I go? Just stand in this room with me now. I don't like it. Tell me about it. I've been here since 1983. Or whenever. I don't know when God started, but... I'm not religious. I don't know if there's a God. That's all I can say, honestly, is I don't know. Some people think that they know that there isn't. That's a weird thing to think you can know. Yeah, there's no God. Are you sure? Yeah, no, there's no God. How do you know? Because I didn't see him. How do you... There's a vast universe you can see for about 100 yards when there's not a building in the way. How could you possibly... Did you look everywhere? Did you look in the downstairs bathroom? Where have you looked so far? No, I didn't see him yet. I haven't seen 12 Years a Slave yet. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I'm waiting until it comes on cable.
That's hysterical and very profound. Can you talk a little bit about the process of writing that and deciding you were going to do a bit about is there a God?
When they asked me to host the show again, to me, the one thing I wanted to really have was a great monologue. That's the biggest audience I ever see, is the top of the show, Saturday Night Live. I don't know how many people it is, but it's something like, I don't know, 4 million people watch that show. And don't know 4 million people watch my show. Like, nobody, I never tap 4 million people except for in SNL's monologue. So... the first time I did the hosted SNL, I learned something that I didn't know, which is that the audience there is a pretty young audience. They're families that go together. It's kind of a Disney audience. It's very and I'm not putting these people down. They're tourists from outside of New York usually, and they're not a dark people. You know what I mean? Like in their intent or their feelings, they're not nightclub stand up. You know, let it hang out people. They're cheerful, ready for a good show, sweet, sweet middle of the America people.
Not your audience.
Not my audience. Well, I mean, I play to those audiences all over the country. I play every city in America. Uh-huh. But usually when I go to like Minneapolis, yeah, I'm tapping Minneapolis's more nefarious types. I'm not
right.
I'm not getting the Chamber of Commerce and the, you know, the Catholic League coming. So... yeah, I thought I want to do something that's compelling and really a good monologue, but the crowd might not be there for it. They may not be their thing. So I trained for that monologue. I did a lot of sets in town, and I did a lot of clubs where there was no audience really, or places where I knew I would do poorly, because I wanted to be sure that the monologue would go well whether the audience liked me or not. But I kept working on the set, working on the ideas in the set and connecting to the material and not worrying about what the audience was doing. And then I got lucky that the crowd at SNL was awesome. They loved it and they were ready for it and they were excited. And something I've learned over the years is that when you talk about religion, you want to talk to religious people. Even if you're talking about something that's contrary religiously or provocative, a religious audience is a better audience for that. If you talk to a bunch of cool atheists in leather and suede, you know, sucking on their vape sticks or whatever they're doing, they're not going to get it because they don't even think about God. They don't. It's not even on their radar, you know. So there, it's. But if you tell religious people, I don't know if there's a God. I don't think there's a heaven. Where's God's ex-wife? These things, they have a connection to it that means something.
There's a great episode of Jerry Seinfeld's. What's it called? Comedians getting coffee. Yeah.
Yes.
Where he picks you up in a weird little doorless orange mm-hmm. car, and then you take him on your boat. You actually have a yacht on the river in New York, and
there's this
incredible story that you tell. It's a long and wonderful story that people should just go watch. But
yeah.
I was wondering, did you see the Redford film All Is Lost?
I did see it. Yes, I did.
Because he's on this yacht in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and like one disaster after another happens,
yes.
And you know, the boat is like sinking and sinking, and he's alone. And
yep.
How did that make you feel about your God?
I got anxious. I didn't like that movie because you shouldn't see movies about something you know about because I'm very into the boating and I know how to navigate. I'm not. There's a lot of people better than me, but I can get my boat all the way up the Hudson and I can get it out. I can get it to Cape Cod from New York. I can go a lot of places and I know what I'm doing. I'm not nearly as experienced as a lot of captains, but this guy in that movie, he made so many stupid choices. So every 10 seconds I was just yelling at the screen, get that stuff out of the water. There was a million things he could have done to ensure his safety that he didn't. He's trying to figure out how to use a flare gun. Mike, who doesn't know how to use a flare gun? Who's in the ocean? You're in the open ocean and you're sleeping. He didn't have his water anchor out. A million things that he did that were stupid and just made me mad. I love boating. I love to learn. That's my favorite thing in life is learning stuff. And the idea that if you're a person standing next to – I have this 42-foot boat that can sleep six people and it can go anywhere almost in the world. I love that I used to stand next to a boat and go, I have no idea how to do that. And now I do from trying it. And I know the waters all around New York Harbor and all the way up to Massachusetts. I know the depths of a lot of these places. I know where the boating channels are. I'm very careful because I have my kids on the boat a lot. So I don't go out in bad weather. I'm very thorough with checking reports before I go anywhere. But yeah, it's one of my favorite things. That's my thing I love to do when I'm not working.
Do you have that confidence on stage? Like, I know how to do this. If there's a hurricane,
sure. Yes,
the audience
I do.
Hates me, I know what to do.
That's exactly right. There really isn't a situation on stage that I feel like I won't know how to handle it. There are some that I know I can't overcome. There are things where I'm like, well, this crowd's just not going to like me. But I also have a plan for that. I know how to stay. You have to stay cool. You can't let them change your plan. So, yes, I have that confidence on stage. I know even if it doesn't – if I don't open well, it'll be okay. Even if I lose them, I'll get them back. And that's come from never shying away. When I was first starting in New York, they had prom shows where they'd fill the audience with kids that were just at their prom. And they're all drunk on limousine booze. And there's no – as soon as you get on stage, they start yelling at you. They start booing as soon as you get this – before deciding if they like you or not. They think it's fun to just start booing when you hit the stage. And I used to eat prom shows for dinner. I used to book as many prom shows as I could. First of all, they pay twice as much money because it's so hard. It's the only time comedy clubs are ever compassionate to comedians is that they'll pay you twice the money for a prom show. But I've been on stage with people yelling and booing and throwing stuff at me, and I've hung in there. I know how to handle that. So nothing scares me now on stage.
That's great.
But if it starts raining, I park my boat. I'm out of my depth there.
Louis C.K. writes, directs, and stars in the FX comedy series Louis. You can find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. In June 1970, Miles Davis played four nights at Bill Graham's Fillmore East Rock Palace in New York, following earlier appearances there and at San Francisco's Fillmore West. A complete recording of all four of those musical sets are now available for the first time. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the jazz trumpeter had gone to the Fillmore in search of a new audience.
Good evening. With great pleasure, Mr. Miles Davis.
It messed jazz people up, the music Miles Davis made in 1970, like the four sets recorded that June, now issued complete on Miles at the Fillmore. 2 years earlier, he'd been leading one of the most beloved jazz bands ever, the one with Wayne Shorter and Herbie Hancock. Then he went electric. Instead of playing jazz clubs, now he was playing to kids who came out to hear the rock bands he split bills with. As one of those rock kids who saw Miles at the Fillmore in 1970, I gotta admit, the music was too weird for me. But later, I could not stop thinking about Chick Corea and Keith Jarrett on electric keyboards. Miles Davis's classic ballads were disarmingly spare. This music for seven players could get absurdly dense, a bubbling stew of independent parts. Now Miles's jams sounded like they could go on forever. But he was still jazz man enough to cue the end of a set with the traditional bebop sign-off theme. Any familiar tunes Miles Davis played that season dissolved into the new band's acid bath, like Wayne Shorter's Footprints, a bonus number in this 4-CD set recorded at the Fillmore West. Now the tunes didn't so much provide a form to improvise over as much as supply moments of relief from the chaos. Bits of melody function as signposts along a strange highway. Dave Holland on bass guitar and Jack DeJohnette on drums. As in other Miles bands, there was a tug of war between the leader and his younger sidemen. He fed on their new ideas, but then they'd want to take things further out than he did. Miles wanted to be commercial, not avant-garde. He didn't just want to sell records like a rock star. He wanted to be a rock star. Wanted to be Hendrix at the Fillmore. That allowed keyboard players Corea and Jarrett to go nuts with their wah-wah pedals, making guitar music without guitars. That was the sweet spot Miles was aiming for, where the groove was all and the fabric wasn't quite so frayed. That said, in the 80s, when his bands really got slick and funky, the music was frequently terrible. He needed headstrong players like this crew who'd push back a bit. The crazy quilt nature of the music Miles Davis made at the Fillmore in 1970 is one of its best features. His rowdy players showed him other ways to bring the funk.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Wondering Sound and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed the new box set Miles Davis, Miles at the Fillmore, on the Columbia Legacy label. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with retired Marine dog handler Jose Armenta. It was Armenta's job to walk ahead of his platoon, searching for IEDs with his dog Zenit, a German shepherd trained for explosives detection and patrol. On a mission in Afghanistan in 2011, searching for IEDs planted by the Taliban, an IED they didn't detect exploded. Armenta was thrown 20 feet. He narrowly survived, but both legs had to be amputated above the knee. Zenit was uninjured and was redeployed with a new handler. Armento was surprised by how much he missed his canine partner and embarked on a complicated and time-consuming process to adopt him. He finally succeeded. He not only has his dog, but Armento and his wife now have a baby. Jose Armento is profiled in National Geographic's June cover story, Hero Dogs.
Jose Armento, welcome to Fresh Air. So can you describe what the process you used was for searching for IEDs with your dog?
Yeah, I can't get into too much detail.
Oh, because you don't want to give anything away?
That's correct. You don't want to give away too many of our training techniques or working techniques.
Good point.
But it involved searching and patterns that we trained to do and to cover danger areas that we may cross while on a mission to find IEDs.
So when you went on a mission with your dog partner, Zenit, you knew the mission was really dangerous. You know what's at stake, and you know the importance of the mission. The dog doesn't really know that, right?
No. All he knows is if he accomplished the task we give him, he'll get a toy, a reward at the end. So that's why it's really important for our dogs that we used to have high drive. They need to really love the game. That's what it is to them, is the game. And if they know if they complete the game and they do it right, they'll get a toy at the end of it. That's all they have on their mind, is just to get that toy.
Is it a lot of extra work to have a dog as a partner in a war zone? Like when you were in Afghanistan, what did you have to do to take care of Zenit?
Well, it is a lot of extra work. In my opinion, taking care of a dog is kind of like taking care of a child. You have to feed it, bathe it, groom it, make sure, you know, it stays safe. And so we have to do all of that in a combat zone. So not only do you have the stress of just combat, but now you have to take care of this dog who doesn't know how to take care of himself. You have to take care of him. So taking his temperature periodically throughout the day to make sure he's not overheating because of the extreme conditions, trimming his nails, carrying his food and water for missions. So it entails a lot of tasks.
Now, you said that the Marines make it clear that you have to be emotionally detached from the dog and that the dog has to be emotionally detached from you. So that if something happens to either of you, the other can continue with the deployment without getting, you know, like becoming an emotional mess. So what do you do to foster that feeling of detachment? I mean, people get so attached to their animals.
Yeah, and every dog handler is different, just like every dog's different. For me, it wasn't that difficult. I think it probably had something to do with my upbringing. I was used to not being emotionally attached to anything, and so it wasn't too difficult. And especially since I had a dog prior to him, and I had to leave that dog to go to my next unit. And so that dog belonged to the previous unit, and so I had to leave him, and that's when I picked up Zenit, was at my next unit. So I had already had to leave a dog to another handler, and so it was clear that I couldn't become attached to any dog.
So you started self-preservation.
Exactly.
So would you describe what the mission was on the day you were injured?
Well, a lot of that day and my time in Afghanistan is a little blurry, probably because of the explosion and all the medication I was on. But up until that point, we really hadn't encountered too many IEDs. It was more of just direct enemy fire, which was surprising because that area was known for having a lot of IEDs, and the unit that was just south of us were getting pounded by IEDs. I mean, we were seeing explosions day in and day out in the distance, and we knew they were having a hard time. And a couple of our missions were to go into that unit's area and kind of help them out because they're having a hard time with the insurgency in that area.
So do you have any idea what detonated the IED that injured you?
Oh, yeah. So they're homemade landmines that are detonated by completing a charge. You step on a piece of wood and it'll push down and two little metal pieces will touch and then the explosion happens.
And you stepped on it?
That's correct. I stepped on it.
Was it buried deep enough that you didn't see it?
Yeah, yeah. We had found, prior to me stepping on the IED, we had found about four. And they were all visible because they were planted at the entry points of the canal that we were in. And so we could see them once we were in. If you were stepping into the canal, you wouldn't be able to see them. They were covered up on top of them so that if you were coming in using the likely entry point, you wouldn't see it and you'd step on it. Since we were in already, we could see them. The one I stepped on was completely buried, so I couldn't see it.
Do you remember what went through your mind when you realized that you'd stepped on an IED?
I don't remember my exact thoughts, but like I said, a lot of it was blurry, and it comes back when I hear it told by someone else who was there. So the Nat Geo journalist asked my buddy kind of what happened after the blast, and he said that something, and it kind of brought back some memories that after I was blown up, I kept saying, I effed up. And by that I meant, you know, I missed one. And so I think that was my first thought, was that I screwed up.
But Xena, your dog was not hurt, right?
No. You know, he was about 20 feet in front of me, so he was lucky.
After you were injured while you were lying there waiting for medical help and for a medevac to helicopter you out of there, did Zenit stay with you?
That's correct. My buddy, Sergeant Maroney, he's the guy that saved my life while I was over there. He told me and told the journalist that Zenit had to come back and lay down next to us. And then it's protocol after a dog is injured or his handler that we're medevac together. Will we stay together?
So you weren't really conscious enough to be aware, or maybe you just don't have enough memory of that moment to know that Xena was there with you.
No, I know I did ask about him. I asked a couple questions after I made those statements that I had effed up, and I asked where was Xena, and my buddy Maroney told me, hey, he's right here. And then I asked him, do I still have my legs? And he was treating me for shock, so he started changing the subject and, you know, doing what he knows he had to do to save my life.
What did he do to save your life?
Well, we're trained to right away put a tourniquet on the legs or the limbs that are missing. We get extensive first aid training for, you know, the aftermath of an IED, because we know that's the main threat out there. So he right away would put a tourniquet on me, applied direct pressure to any of my wounds, hooked me up on an IV, and started taking my mind off of my injury so that I'm not freaking out.
At what point did you realize you did lose your legs?
I don't remember the exact point. It just kind of happened. I remember waking up in Germany kind of knowing that my legs were gone. Maybe I had woken up and they told me when I was drugged up or something like that, but it just kind of, I gradually became aware that I was missing my legs.
I've read that before you were injured, you'd said that you'd rather die than survive without one of your limbs, that you didn't want to be half a man. Is that how you felt in the early days after you realized that your legs were gone?
No. Surprisingly, I was pretty happy to be alive. You know, before my injury, that's usually the mindset that a lot of us had was, you know, if we're going to get blown up, we'd rather just die on the battlefield than come back missing half our body. But after I had been through the whole experience, I was happy to be alive.
So, you know, we talked a little bit about the mission you were on when you were injured and a little bit about what you went through. Let's talk some more about your dog, Zenit. Zenit was not injured. So after you started going through your recovery, Zenit was redeployed, given another handler. Was Zenit sent back into Afghanistan?
After I was injured, my dog was assigned to another dog handler, and they went on and completed the deployment, the six-month deployment, because I was at the halfway point, about 3 months when I was injured. And so Xena went on for another 3 months doing missions with another dog handler.
In Afghanistan?
That's correct.
Okay. So did you miss Zenit as you were starting to, you know, like come back into your senses and begin your recovery?
Yeah, I did. It was surprising because up until that point, I had made sure that I was emotionally detached from Zenit. I tried to keep it strictly professional since I knew it was very likely that one of us would be injured and performing our job. And so I tried not to get too emotionally attached to him. But after the fact, after I was out of the battlefield and recovering and I had found out that he was assigned to another handler, I was kind of angry. I didn't want him in danger anymore. I want him back home with me. Until that's when it kind of became evident. And that's when my emotions were evolving from a professional relationship to more of a partnership and a friendship.
Did you worry that when you were finally reunited with your dog, Zenit, that Zenit wouldn't remember you? Because, you know, Zenit had at least one other handler. There might have been more than that. And was, you know, had been back in Afghanistan, back on missions. I mean, that's a lot to go through. Did you think maybe you'd finally get Zenit back and Zenit wouldn't really know who you were?
That was one of my fears. Another reason why we try to detach ourselves from the dog as much as possible is for that very reason, that we're not to attach, so that if the handler is injured or killed, or the dog or the handler can go in and start another team up again and operate efficiently. And so I wasn't sure whether Zena was detached from me just like I was from him, and he was going to go in and create a bond with another handler and maybe forget about his old handler. But that wasn't the case.
So would you describe the scene for us when you were reunited?
Yeah. Well, we were reunited at 29 Palms, the Marine Corps base in Southern California. And I was in the wheelchair at the time. And he kind of just jumped on me with his two paws and started giving me a licking. And that's when I knew, hey, he remembers me.
So what did you do after, like, when you realized Zenit remembered you? Did you then, like, play or talk with him, or like where does the reunion go after that?
Oh, well, after exchanging a couple kisses, we jumped in my truck and started the road trip back home to San Diego. And I, once we got there, I just started trying to accustomize him to civilian life and show him the retired life that he deserves.
What do you think some of the most difficult parts were in Zenit's adjustment to civilian life?
Oh, just getting used to not being told what to do, or you know, every minute of the day. He was used to taking a lot of orders and to always training, you know, always playing around, which a lot of times that's what they like, especially German Shepherds and the breeds that we use. These dogs love to be active. They love to have jobs. And so for him, it was kind of like, okay, now it's time to wind down. And for the first month, that's what he was doing. He would just sit there and stare at me and wait for a command. And gradually, as time went on, he relaxed and, you know, laid down and waited until we went outside and played fetch.
So how does the civilian Zenit compare to the military Zenit in terms of his personality?
Oh, it changed a lot. A lot of these dogs, they have emotion when you give them their toy, when you're praising them for a job well done. But other than that, you don't see a lot of emotion out of them. They know, hey, we got to play the game. At the end of the game, then we have fun. But now, you know, now he chases his tail and digs holes in the yard and loves steaks. And I don't think he ever knew what a steak was. And so yeah, he's changed a lot.
You were engaged when you were in Afghanistan.
That's correct.
After you were injured by the IED and you lost your legs, did you fear that your fiancé would leave you because you weren't who you were before?
Yeah, that's definitely a big fear. And I think that's probably one of the biggest fears that a lot of us have. And we kind of come up with our own conclusion that obviously, you know, our wife or our girlfriend or fiance is going to have to move on and start another life somewhere else. But that wasn't the case. In fact, I had told Eliana, which is my wife, I told her at my bedside, if you want to leave, now's the time to do it. And, you know, she told me to shut up and that she was there to stay around. So I'm a lucky guy.
You know, earlier we were talking about how before the explosion, you had said, like a lot of other soldiers, that you would rather die on the battlefield than come home without one of your limbs, that you didn't want to be half a man. So now that you know, you still have a life, you're married, you have a baby, you have your dogs, you have, you're in school full time. I mean, it sounds like you're happy to be alive. Have you rethought what it means to be a man? Since you were afraid, like, if you lost a limb, you'd be half a man. But I mean, you're still a man.
That's correct. Yeah, my point of views and the way I think have changed quite a bit. At the time, I was 23 and a young Marine who just wanted a lot of action and to accomplish missions and, you know, do what a Marine does. You know, I grew up on kind of the bad side of town, and you always saw a man as a tough guy. And so naturally, when I joined the military, I wanted to join the Marine Corps because that's where all the tough guys are. And so I did that, and so my perception of a man was a, you know, tough guy that could accomplish anything and run through a brick wall. Now, what it means to be a man is, you know, to be a good father and a good husband, and to, you know, try to achieve all your goals and be the best person you can be. So, yeah, my perception of a man has changed a lot.
Jose Armenta is profiled in National Geographic's June cover story, Hero Dogs. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.